All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080544, N. Ray Scoggins Construction Company, Inc., an original proceeding from Hidalgo County. Docket number 080613, NAFTA Traders, Inc. versus Margaret A. Quinn from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 080660, N. Ray Satterfield and Pontikes Construction, Inc., another original proceeding from Hidalgo. I will be participating in all three causes, but will not be here for the second and third arguments this morning. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of the arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument now in 080544, N. Ray Scoggins Construction Company, Inc.
May it please the court. Mr. Morgan will present argument for the relator. Relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm Craig Morgan, representing relator and defendant Scoggins Construction Company. The fundamental question in this mandamus proceeding is whether the interests of this defendant in having its contractual rights and liabilities determined in a fair and timely fashion is entitled to the same weight and dignity as the interests of this plaintiff in having its contractual claim decided in a fair and timely manner. If the answer to that question is no, that the interests of the plaintiff in pursuing its contractual claim against Scoggins outweighs the interests of Scoggins in pursuing its contractual claims against the subcontractor, subcontractors arising out of the same construction project, if the answer to that is no, then the trial court's order was possibly correct and should be permitted to stand. If the answer, however, is yes, the interests of Scoggins, the defendant, in preserving its contractual rights arising out of this project is entitled to the same dignity and respect as the interests of the plaintiff, the school district, the owner of the project, then the order is wrong and must be corrected.
Mr. Morgan, there's a question about whether the parties were agreeable to the motion that the trial court granted the order on, about which we're here today. Is there an agreement among the parties that addresses the dispute we're here about today?
You're talking about agreement about joinder?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the plaintiffs are willing to agree to a joinder, that's fine with us, but it's not the plaintiffs, not the school district that entered the order that's the subject of this mandamus proceeding. The time for the school district to have not opposed that motion was some 2 years ago when it was originally filed. The order that's at issue in this proceeding was entered on the 2nd of April, 2008, and by which the trial court denied Scoggins' motion to join these subcontractors as third-party defendants so all the claims could resolve in one proceeding. That order is still in full force and effect and has not been modified. The school district's willingness to withdraw its opposition is simply irrelevant at this point. Furthermore, even if the order had been withdrawn and changed, that would not necessarily deny this court of jurisdiction to address the issue.
If there's no opposition now to your motion, it was, I guess, the motion for leave to join third-party defendants and to designate responsible third parties. I think you were seeking to add about 20 subcontractors.
20 subcontractors, that's correct.
There's no opposition to it, and I understand that there's a order pending at the trial court denying that motion. If if the parties...
Excuse me, Your Honor, the motion has been denied.
Okay, the order had been signed by the trial
right.
court denying your
the
motion.
The order that is the subject of
it's
this...
It's existing at the trial court.
That's correct. That this is not a pending motion.
If... Yeah, I said a pending order. I meant existing
okay.
order.
Right.
If the parties are agreeable to that and the trial court... hearing that withdrawal of opposition is willing to change its order, then that moots your issue here, doesn't it?
No, it does not, Your Honor. First of all, because, as I mentioned, the school district's willingness to not oppose the motion that's already been denied doesn't mean the trial court's going to change the order.
Assume that after argument,
right.
While we're cogitating on your dispute, that you address the trial court about this and the trial court changes its order and grants your motion, then the issue you're disputing here today goes away.
Not necessarily under the In Re Allied Chemical Corporation decision, because this issue is simply a matter of would evade review of a matter that is capable of repetition and in fact is being repeated as we speak. Right now there is a case in front of this court to be heard this morning involving essentially the same issue that dealt with a trial court's sua sponte severance of subcontractors.
That's the Satterfield case.
That's
that we're
correct.
Arguing third today.
There's correct. There's another
trial
case.
Trial court reverses its order on your motion. In this case, you're saying we would still need to answer that question.
The question is still capable of being repeated, not only in this case, as in Satterfield, for example. The district could reverse its position again. The trial court could sua sponte determine to sever the subcontractors. And furthermore, there are other pending cases in which the same issue has arisen. There are, in fact, arising out of the same disputes involving initially germinating from the same lawsuit, there are five other cases against Scoggins brought by the school district concerning five other school districts, constructions of five other projects, in which Scoggins has also sought to join the subcontractors in that lawsuit. All five of those actions that were severed from this one are pending in front of the trial court right now with those motions abated while the trial court waits for this court's decision in this mandamus proceeding to determine whether its refusal to join the subcontractors was proper here so that it can repeat that decision in the other five pending cases. The school district has not consented to the joinder in those five other cases.
How much does your argument depend on the docket control order deadline?
Not significantly, not critically, certainly, because although the joinder motion was filed a day or two before the docket control order said the joinder motions had to be filed, it was filed only 6 months after the counterclaim was initially filed.
But it was within the trial court's discretionary period whether to allow joinder.
The joinder motion was not filed within the first 30 days
right.
of Scoggins's answer and could not have been, realistically speaking.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out, is your position that because the docket control order had a date for joinder, that there was an unfettered right to join people by the docket control order date? Or are we talking just more about the parameters of a trial court's discretion?
Well, the existence of the docket control order and the fact that we complied with it should at least create a presumption that there was no problem with untimeliness of the motion.
How broad is the trial court's discretion when 4 months before trial, 20 subcontractors are brought in? It is significant that this is a contract claim rather than a tort claim, it seems to me. I can see an argument being made that the way to streamline this litigation is pinpointing the contract action, the scope of the alleged defects, and then in a more streamlined proceeding allow the general contractor to go against its subcontractors pursuant to the contracts that are found liable in the first case. In other words, this case is going to be pretty long and drawn out if you've got 20 subs in there. And the issues aren't really related to the narrow contract question before the court.
Well, the problem here is, Your Honor, that doing this in two proceedings will not streamline it at all.
Well, that's arguable.
No, it's not, Your Honor. It's quite frankly not arguable. Because in the first case, the only question the jury is going to be asked to resolve is whether there were any defects, in the construction of this school building, whether It will be asked whether Scoggins Construction breached its contract to produce this school building in a manner, was in a good and workmanlike fashion. And if not, if it did breach that contract, how much the school district's damages are. It will, if it says, if the jury determines that there were any deficiencies in the construction of this school project, which could range from anywhere from the allegations of the defects in the roof, to the parking lot, to the windows, to the plumbing, all of which the plaintiff's experts now contend are defective, the jury will simply return a finding that yes, Scoggins breached the contract in X amount of damages. In the second proceeding, Scoggins will then be suing the subcontractors to recover its contractual damages. Its contractual damages will be the amount, will include, at least as a minimum, the amount by which it was held liable in the first proceeding. After all, Scoggins is not the owner of the building. It's not actually directly damaged by any defects in its construction. Its damages for the breach, for subcontractor's breach of contract will include the amount by which it was held liable for that breach in the first proceeding. But it will be proceeding against 20 subcontractors.
Well, not all of them.
It won't know. That's the point, Your Honor. Well, it will have no idea what the first jury found. There will be, ultimately, try to conceptualize how that second proceeding is going to go.
Well, I would think that a defendant would try to pin down on the plaintiff what the defect is. Was it the roof? Was it the HVAC? Was it concrete? Or whatever it might be, drywall. And you're going to know, because the plaintiff's going to have to point to that when it's taking it to the jury as to what the alleged defects are, aren't you?
No, they're not, Your Honor. Their experts have already claimed defects in all those areas in which the work was done by 20 separate subcontractors. There's no reason to believe that they can't or won't present evidence of all those defects in the trial court in the first proceeding of the breach of contract claim. The second jury, in the second proceeding, neither the subcontractors nor that jury will be bound by the finding in the first proceeding, even if they knew why the defects were found. In the second proceeding, Scoggins will have the burden of showing that its liability in the first lawsuit was a result of the following defects by these subcontractors. There is simply no way that that will ever be knowable. In fact, the public policy of this state is that you can't know it, because you can't bring the jurors in the first proceeding as witnesses in the second trial and ask them, well, what was it that caused you to determine this building was defective and in what amounts? One can easily foresee wildly inconsistent verdicts from the second proceeding as in the first. And you can foresee an appeal by any subcontractor in that second proceeding claiming that Scoggins didn't prove causation, because Scoggins will be unable to present any convincing, perhaps persuasive, perhaps any evidence at all to show the basis for the liability found in the first proceeding. It will simply say, well, I have a judgment for $10 million against me based upon the jury's finding in the first proceeding that this building was defectively constructed. And the following was all the evidence that the plaintiff presented in that first proceeding to prove that these subcontractors did their work improperly. Now here, jury, in the second proceeding, you guess and why the first jury found me liable for this defective construction, and you determine which subcontractors did it wrong.
So how would you foresee it would be submitted in a combined trial? You'd have issues related to Scoggins, and then you'd have separate issues related to each of the subcontractors?
That would be one way to do it. Perhaps you could have, depending upon how the evidence unfolded at the trial, you could have, was there a defect in the construction of the roof? And if so, X amount. Was there a construction in the defect of the parking lot? And if so, what are the damages? Was there a defect in the construction of the plumbing?
How would you craft a judgment if you don't tie it to any particular subcontractor?
Well, you presumably the evidence would tie that to subcontractors. Do you find any defect in the plumbing work done by subcontractor X? Do you find a defect in the plumbing in the roofing work done by subcontractor Y? I mean, this is not unworkable. The problem is that doing it in two trials, it would, as the trial court's order would currently require, is utterly unworkable as to Scoggins.
Do you foresee needing in Justice Green's hypothetical, a proportionate responsibility question for each subcontractor as well?
That depends upon whether there's a tort claim. I mean, the plaintiffs argue that this is simply a breach of contract claim.
The real parties have offered, if this agreement carries through, to add a negligence claim in addition to withdrawing the motion, your opposition to your motion.
If there is a tort claim, then I presume that there would be a proportionate responsibility allocation question under Chapter 33, as in any other tort. If it remains a straight, if as the district insists, their claim is a straightforward contract action, then there would simply be a question about who breached which contracts.
But isn't that the very purpose of entering into these contracts, to streamline any sort of proceedings afterwards? The district, if there are problems, doesn't have to bring in all the subcontractors and have a long protracted trial. They try it against you, and then you can proceed against the subs. I mean, isn't that the purpose of this type of contract?
No, it's not to permit multiple litigation. It's to give the owner one party to whom to look for recovery. That doesn't mean that the owner is entitled to prevent the general contractor from preserving its contractual rights against the subcontractors by bringing them into the same litigation, so that the same jury that determines Scoggins' liability to the district can determine the subcontractor's liability to Scoggins. After all, these are exactly the same facts. These are not intertwined facts. These are precisely the same facts.
What if this had been attempted 2 weeks before trial?
Well, then that would be different.
Why?
But it wasn't. If there would have been an unreasonable delay, it depends on the circumstances. If, for example, if the pleadings were as they were here, which is just global, a nonspecific, saying the building was not properly constructed, and it was only through the course of discovery of the district's experts that the defendant was able to determine what the precise defects were, and it was not until 2 weeks before the trial that was possible, then I think the defendant would be in a good position to contend that they didn't know which subcontractors to bring in, and that it would be egregiously bad public policy to require them to simply bring them in all in.
But that's what happened here, right?
No, it's not. There were 50 to 60 subcontractors who worked on this project. Now, the district's position is that Scoggins should have simply brought them all in within 30 days without having any reasonable basis for believing that the work of any of them was actually at issue. Scoggins instead took the far more reasonable approach, the one this court should encourage, which is to conduct a discovery and find out exactly what it was the school district was really claiming was wrong with the building. And once it did that, it identified the subcontractors who did that work and brought only them in. That's perfectly reasonable, and it couldn't be done within 30 days. I see my time has expired.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument now from the real parties in interest.
May it please the court. Mr. Shidlovsky will present argument for the real party in interest.
May it please the court. The question before this court is whether the trial court clearly abused its discretion in refusing to allow 20 subcontractors a few months before trial in a contract case. Nobody disputes here that it's a contract case.
Let me ask you about the same questions we asked petitioner earlier. Has your agreement not to oppose the joinder of the parties resolved the controversy, or what's your position on that?
We have offered to Scoggins basically all the relief that they seek in this court. We have said, you can join them in, we'll add a negligence claim. Mind you, we don't think a negligence claim is even viable because of the economic, but we'll add it so you can add responsible third parties. We'll give you everything that you have asked for. And they said no. And the reason why they said no, presumably, was because they're not mandamusing us, they're mandamusing the trial court. We even said, we'll join in. They said no.
Have you presented an agreed order to the trial court?
We can't, Your Honor, because this court stayed all proceedings.
If after argument we stay the proceedings for that opportunity, would you still stand behind your offer of all the relief that they're asking for?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And let me just make clear that...
And then take that to the trial court?
We will, Your Honor. And the reason is simple. We are waving the white flag here, so to speak, but it has nothing to do with the merits of this. We think we're absolutely right. We think the judge was absolutely right and that it's clear discretion, and that we should prevail on the merits. Simply put, we decided to go this route because we're 17 months into appellate litigation here, and the school hasn't gone one step closer to being fixed, and the school board just made a decision, we give up.
Are there 5 other cases pending where this issue is teed up before the trial judges or judge in Hidalgo County?
There are 5 other cases. It's being handled by different underlying lawyers. I am not aware, it's certainly not on the record, I am not aware that this issue is teed up. I was under the impression that they had sued the subcontractors in the same case, but I do not know for sure whether this issue is teed up or not in those other 5 cases. There are 5 other pending cases, though. Certainly, we do have the Met case, which is pending in this court, and we do have the Satterfield and Ponticus case, but I believe in Satterfield and Ponticus, the same issue. They've waved the white flag, so to speak, and agreed to all the relief that the other side has requested.
Let's talk about the merits just a moment, because he said it's capable of repetition. How would you submit this case? How could the contractor protect themselves from simply inability to show causation as to any subcontractor in a second suit if you simply your contract says you guarantee the construction, and under our broad form, the trial court may well just submit a single issue with 1 damages number in there, and the defendant could object, but then you're back into the appellate system, and we just have all this stuff cycling through our system over and over again.
Well, I think the problem, though, Justice Johnson, is that it's based on a false premise that there's going to be inevitably inconsistent results. In the first trial...
Well, there's not. He's not saying inconsistency. He's just saying he can't prove causation as to any particular subcontractor if he takes a $10 million judgment based upon 1 finding of liability and 1 damage finding, and he tries to sue those subs, and it seems like he has a pretty valid complaint. How am I ever going to show which sub is responsible for which part of it in the subsequent litigation?
That happens every day in contractual indemnity cases where somebody gets sued, doesn't bring in the other person, and then after a judgment is awarded or after a settlement, they then go try to pursue.
Okay, it happens all the time. Would you explain to me how he can show causation as to the roofing contractor in the second case, if in the first case the finding is there is, yes, the contractor breached the contract and $10 million of damages goes to the school district? How does he go sue the roofing contractor and show the roofing contractor is responsible for $376,000 of that? How can he do that?
How he allocates those damages is his burden. Now, I understand that is a tough issue, how he allocates the exact amount.
Tough? How does he do it at all?
Well, because there's going to be, in defending themselves at the first trial, they're going to have to say, this wasn't wrong, this wasn't wrong, this wasn't wrong. Now, the jury's going to come back, he's correct, with 1 answer, $5 million. He then takes that and he goes after the particular subs where the evidence came in.
He has to take the evidence from the first trial and read it into the second trial? Or does he have somebody testify about what the evidence was in the first trial and take that?
There's going to be expert reports presented in the first trial, expert testimony presented in the first trial.
The jury could ignore completely the roof and find it all on the HVAC. And we don't know, and that's what his complaint is.
That's correct. But again, what he's trying to do, what Scoggin is trying to do there is take the burden, shift it from them, and put it on to the school district. We have a contract with them.
No, he's not trying to put the burden on you, as I understand. He just wants to bring the others in so when this first trial is over, it may take a long time, but at least everybody knows you can submit the individual parts so everybody will know what the result is, and then you can go up on appeal 1 time, it seems like.
Well, again, I think that decision of whether or not to bring in those is in the wide discretion of the trial judge. And this trial judge decided, using her wide discretion, that that she didn't want to allow in the
so 20. So that means the trial court can use its discretion to make one trial and then the subsequent trials, and we appeal the first trial while they're appealing the $10 million verdict that you obtained from them on some evidentiary, or the others are waiting, or we try those others, or, I mean, that's within the trial court's discretion to just kind of spread it all out into the system.
There's no doubt that this creates two lawsuits. We're not disputing that. One
or 20. He says he's going to sue 20 subs.
In one lawsuit. He's not going to sue 20 subs in 20 different lawsuits.
He maybe yes, maybe no. We don't know that, do we?
Well, he sought to bring them all in one lawsuit in this case. So, I mean, I think that the natural course of things, he's going to sue. And he may not even sue the 20 after our lawsuit, because after the initial lawsuit, we may only put on evidence of 5 defects, or may put on evidence of 4 defects, or their evidence against us in the first may be so good as to some that they decide they're only going to go after 3 or 4 of the subcontractors. I think just the O'Neill point was right. I think this is a way to streamline it. Yes, there's going to be 2 trials, but you got to remember, in the contract that we signed with the general contractor, they agreed to be responsible. So we sued just them. The contract says we can look to just them to remedy our problems. And then it's up to them to go out. And nobody's disputing here. They're not disputing that they have a right to go after them in a subsequent lawsuit. They just want to create, in essence, a proportional responsibility standard for a breach of contract case. And right or wrong, it doesn't exist in Texas. There is no proportionate responsibility for contracts, but that is in essence what they're trying to do here.
Well, the amicus shed some light on how this industry operates, at least in the main, under AIA contracts, and the amicus says that for the indemnity provisions that the subcontractors have in their contracts and owe to the general contractor, they have to get a percentage of responsibility in order to assert the indemnities. And those indemnity disputes will be based on the exact same facts that will be litigated and determined in this trial, if it's only between you and the relator, right?
I agree that there's 2 main contractual risk transfer tools in a contract like this. There's additional insured status and there's contractual indemnity. For additional insured status, it's never been the law in the state of Texas or any of the other states that the subcontractor has to be a party to the litigation in order for the general contractor to be an additional insured.
Yeah, and he hasn't argued that.
And as to contractual indemnity, nobody disputes. In fact, it's happened for 100 years in this state that lawsuit can be brought afterwards. In fact, the statute of limitations doesn't even begin to run until after the judgment is issued against Goggins in the first place.
But the problem is, though, when there are multiple contracts. If it were just one, obviously that would be correct. Maybe if there were 2, but if there's a number, can you take us through the steps of how the second case would be tried so that the allocation problem could, which you say is a tough issue, could be overcome?
I think what happens is we take the judgment in the first case. So say it's $5 million. Then they go, they pick the subs that they're going to sue, and they put on their evidence of what they think the damages were. And the indemnity agreement that you mentioned says that the contractors are responsible for their own acts.
I'd like to be one of those subs in that second trial, because I'd go back and look at what the contractor said. Contractor in the first trial said there's no defect. There's no defect here whatsoever. We shouldn't be liable. The school is perfect. And then you go to the second trial, and the sub is going to say, see what they said back then.
Well, so then let's go back to the first trial and the second. So what is the Scoggins going to do in the first trial? Is he going to go in there and say, everything's perfect, but if it's not, it's him? I mean, it puts Scoggins actually in an odd position in the first trial itself, too. They say their fear of inconsistent results, but in the first trial, to get the jury submission that they want, that they were talking about, they essentially have to talk out of both sides of their mouth. They have to say, the school is perfect, but if it's not, it's the mason's fault, it's the exterior cladding's fault, it's the you know, that seemingly undercuts their defenses in the first trial.
Isn't that a strategic decision that the contractor has to make in these kind of cases?
It absolutely is a strategic decision, and sometimes the general contractors bring them in, and sometimes they don't. The question is, whose decision is it? Are we going to take that decision out of the trial court's hand and give it to the general contractor? So we decide in all construction defect cases, it's the based on breach of contract, that it's the general contractor's decision whether to join everybody in, or do we allow the trial judge to decide whether or not judicial economy plays a role, whether or not it's better to streamline it in one lawsuit or in two lawsuits?
Have a case on appeal from the second lawsuit that says this was a good idea.
I'm sorry.
Is there any case from an appeal of a second lawsuit like this, like in this situation, that the appellate court said this is a good idea to try it twice?
I'm not aware of any case either way. I mean, we haven't found, and I think both sides admit that, we haven't found a case directly on point on this issue. Most of the cases, all of the cases that they cited were tort cases, where the courts have said because of proportionate responsibility, we should try it all at one time. I can understand those decisions in the proportionate responsibility setting, but this is a breach of contract setting.
But the ultimate problem, practical problem, it's a different legal problem, but the practical problem looks to me like it's exactly the same.
Well, again, it's something, though, that's been faced for years in contractual indemnity claims.
But take me back, though. Why isn't it exactly the same? Because if you had a trial that you didn't allocate responsibility, and you just had is there liability and how much are the damages, and then you had a second trial to allocate that responsibility, I don't see how it could possibly occur, because you would never be sure that what the second jury thought was what the first jury thought.
Well, that's true, but it's also based, they based on the premise that an inconsistent result is one that says $5 million in the first trial, and then let's say in the second trial, they only award Scoggins $3 million. What they argue and what Amicus argues is that is absolutely an inconsistent result, and that can't be right. But that presupposes that the general contractor doesn't have any of its own liability. The very expert reports that they point to inadequate oversight, poor coordination of trades. Those are things that are not the subcontractor's fault. Those are things that go directly against the general contractor. So just because the judgment is different between the first lawsuit and the second lawsuit doesn't mean they're inherently inconsistent results.
What if he tries 10 lawsuits and 10 second lawsuits and gets $15 million and he only has to pay you $5 million? Is that a problem?
I'm not sure that's possible. I think that there would be some equitable problems.
If he spreads them out into 10 lawsuits and each one gets $3 million from each one, it's possible, it seems like, because they're not going to, you know, each jury's going to be individually judging what that independent subcontractor did. It seems like that is a possibility just as much as it's getting $3 million instead of the $5 million when you spread them out like that.
I think there would be a double recovery problem in that sense if he recovered more than he had to pay out.
The first one pays out $3 million and the last one doesn't have to pay any. That doesn't seem like that's very fair though.
But again, if he brings two separate lawsuits?
Say he brings 10 against 10 subs. Mm-hmm. You get $5 million from him and the first sub gets hit for $3 million. Second sub gets hit for $3 million. Third sub gets hit for $3 million. First sub pays his $3 million. What are these others? I mean, you know, and the others get off completely scot-free, it seems like. Or they have, it seems like we're just asking. You could get more, you could get less, and you really have no equitable or right way of figuring out what is right, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, again, I come back, I mean, I understand that this is going to cause a second lawsuit. Nobody disputes that. Again, the question comes back to, though, whether or not that becomes the school district's problem. The school district tried to streamline this by bringing it against a single general contractor, which was entitled to do by its contract, and whether or not the trial judge had a discretion to keep it that way. If they would have brought him in within the first 30 days, trial judge has no discretion. That's what Rule 38 says. Afterwards, they have to move for leave.
Is it any part of your position that they unreasonably delayed discovery and finding out what your allegations were and what parts of the construction you were complaining about?
Well, they did move for special exceptions early on, but they never sent them for hearing.
Okay. But my question was, did they delay in doing discovery and taking depositions? And have you alleged that they unreasonably delayed these several months?
The only thing we say, Your Honor, is that they could have moved for special exceptions earlier. They could have set a hearing to figure out which particular subs, and then they did wait to the day before the docket control order to bring their motion for leave. But again, whether they waited the day before, they waited a week before, I don't think that's the pivotal factor. I think the pivotal factor is whether the introduction of 20 subs 4 months or 5 months before trial is going to unreasonably delay the trial. And we think it unquestionable that it's going to unreasonably delay the trial.
We have said that in determining consolidation or deconsolidation, the dominant consideration in every case is whether the trial will be fair and impartial to all parties. That's in the N. Van Waters versus Rogers case, in which we ordered deconsolidation. And it was a personal injury mass tort case, neither side cites. But in that principle, the controlling principle here, fairness and impartiality to all the parties?
I think fair and impartiality to all parties is a dominant consideration in these cases.
Keeping only Scoggins as the defendant makes it certainly more straightforward for your client. What about all the parties?
I still say that, again, they don't lose any of their rights after we get a judgment. They're not claiming that they can't bring that subsequent lawsuit to try to recover what they were damaged by.
Aren't you entitled to rely on the contract? The contract allows you to just sue the general contractor and let the general contractor go after the subs if they're subs that are responsible?
Absolutely.
That burden's on the other side, right?
Right. But they're absolutely entitled to. No one claims anything different that they can't go back after. They just want to bring it. They just want to force it all into the first trial and say the trial judge has no discretion, essentially, as long as they brought it timely to keep them out.
This seems like an end around to all of that.
Yeah, that's right. And one other issue that we bring up in the briefing, and I understand it's a point that is a issue that may be in a state of flux, is we think that the previous cases decided, for the most part, under 37 and 38, which are the rules that they brought, the courts have decided that on traditional appeal and not mandamus because of the adequate remedy of appeal. There are several cases where the failure to join was brought, or the failure to consolidate, or the failure to sever was brought up by traditional appeals under 37 and 38 under the same abuse and discretion. So I'm not sure that this case even fits within the categories of cases that this court has held is ripe for mandamus review.
Is it your position that the school district wants to try a case, appeal it, and then have a say, if we should decide that way, that it is completely unfair to the defendant because these parties were not joined, and then send it back and retry it again?
No, I mean, that's not my position.
That doesn't seem to be very efficient or good for anybody involved in this.
That's not our position.
But at this point, we don't know how the case will be submitted. The parties could agree, and the trial court could decide to submit it with separate liability questions, or even, sounds like you've agreed to submit responsible third party. So if the charge were submitted in that manner, the problem would be remedied.
We have agreed to everything that they seek in this case. So yes, if we went back, if the stay was lifted, we would go back.
But even if that didn't happen, if the case went to trial as is, without the addition of the parties, you could agree to a charge that included the responsible third party piece in it that would facilitate the second lawsuit.
I suppose we could, yes. I mean, at this case, there's no breach, there's no tort allegations that would allow.
I understand, but I understand you've agreed to responsible third party.
That is correct.
So even if they're not added, that could be submitted.
That is correct.
So we don't know.
Sorry. Of course, that makes your case for your client much more complicated. Instead of one target, you've got 21.
That was the whole point of how we started this, to streamline our case. That is correct.
Any further questions? Yes.
It's readily apparent that there is no way that these cases can be tried in two separate proceedings without severely prejudicing, if not completely eviscerating, Scoggins's right, contractual rights against the subcontractors. The plaintiffs hadn't suggested any. When pressed by this court on those questions, their answers continually fall back to, well, that's Scoggins' problem, we want to streamline the case and so forth. But listen carefully. All they want to do is streamline this case for the school district. Now, it's true that their case will be easier if it's just the school district against Scoggins. The trial will be easier, the evidence will be easier, the charge will be simpler, the case will be over quicker, but that's not the point.
I'm not sure. How would the evidence be any different? Looks like it's going to be the same.
Well, the evidence about the existence of defects would be the same. That's true. But
well,
they would
like all the evidence would be
the trial. The trial will be longer because there will be more people cross-examining the experts and so forth, and they would have to be more specifically directed against which subcontractor did which work. So the trial would be somewhat longer. The evidence about the defects will be exactly the same. But there's no question that it will be easier for the school district. So that comes back to the question I indicated was a fundamental question at the heart of this proceeding. Whether the interests of this defendant and having its contractual rights and liabilities determined in a fair and timely manner is entitled to the same weight and dignity as the interests of this plaintiff and having its contractual claims determined in a fair and timely manner. Now, if the answer to that is no, as the district suggests, that what really matters is streamlining this litigation for them, and all the subsequent problems are simply ours, well, then the trial court's order was probably correct and should be allowed to stand. If the answer, however, is the yes, that our rights to enforce our contractual remedies under the contracts concerning this project are entitled to just as much dignity and weight and should be given just as much respect as the contractual rights of the district, then the trial court's order has to be wrong and must be corrected. And
are we to ignore when the motion to leave was filed and when the joinder was filed? If it was or within 30 days, we're not to consider that? If it's the day before trial, that's, are we to say the trial court abused its discretion because the trial court's not going to streamline this when the joinder was late?
So well, that's not what happened here, Your Honor. This wasn't the day before trial. It was 4 months before the trial setting, which...
Well, what's the problem with the trial order? Is that not an issue?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Is it not an issue on when you joined the third parties?
Oh, if it were belatedly and unreasonably delayed, that would be a factor. But that's clearly not the case here. In fact, the trial court setting, it's curious, that the trial court setting the district contends was only 4 months off and was so critically needed to protect. At that very same hearing, they said was going to be moved to September by agreement of the parties. And besides, that was 13 months ago, and it's long since passed. There's no trial setting here. And the district's only suggestion is that, well, Scoggins should have named every single of the 60 subcontractors in this lawsuit and brought them all in within 30 days so the trial court wouldn't have discretion to deny the motion. That's just nonsense.
So I see what you're saying essentially is that you should be able to control which parties you want to bring in to try this case rather than the trial court.
No, Your Honor.
Because it's not true in every case that you would want to bring in all the subcontractors. I can see a scenario where in defending a case against you, the general contractor, you're friendly with all your subs. They all come in and testify, yeah, there's no defect here. We're all singing out of the same hymnal. But there may be circumstances where you want to you want to be able to go after them in an adversarial situation, and you get to pick the ones that you want to do that with. And that's what you're trying to do here?
I'm sure I don't understand the question. We brought in all 20 of the subcontractors whose work was allegedly defective.
Right.
Or sought to bring them in.
Right, but you could have said, well, we'll stay on friendly terms with them and let them come in and testify for us that work is not defective after all.
Well, if we wanted to completely abandon all of our contractual rights of indemnity against them, which is what that would do, because there's simply no way to enforce those rights meaningfully against the subcontractors in a second proceeding in which we would just have to guess at what the results were, what the basis of the results were in the first proceeding.
Now, my understanding is in some of these construction contracts, is it true that you have some subs who then subcontract out some of their work?
That's true.
And then, so what would happen with those subs? Would they be entitled to then bring in their subs?
I don't know. I guess it would depend upon the terms of their contract.
But it would seem to be the same. I mean,
Well, to the extent of similar contractual obligations and rights, then yes. But my understanding is that was not done extensively here, but it does happen. Yes.
So how are we going to judge and what kind of rule are we going to give some trial court in regard to when we allow, when they have to allow the subs to be brought in, and, or it's an abuse of discretion? Is it we know it when we see it, or do you have something?
Well, Your Honor, the rule that we urge is simply this, that where a property owner sues a general contractor alleging defects in a construction project, and the work at issue is done by subcontractors, and the general contractor has a contractual right to claim against those subcontractors for any damages caused by their defective work, the general contractor may join those subcontractors as third-party defendants so that everyone's rights can be determined in one proceeding, unless the property owner shows that joinder will cause it substantial prejudice by unreasonable delay. And there should be a presumption that where that motion to join occurs within the trial court scheduling order, that there is no such substantial prejudice by unreasonable delay, and there's been no such showing here.
So you're contending for simply a shifting of the burden for them to show.
Yes.
You get to bring them in.
Well, it's not simply a shifting of the burden.
Right. Bad choice of words. You get to bring them in unless the other party shows substantial delay and burden.
Yes. These are claims that arise out of the same facts, same circumstances, and any contrary rule will eviscerate the general contractor's contractual rights. Thank you.
One final question, if I may, Chief. If you were allowed to bring in the subcontractors, but the school district did not allege negligence, could you allege negligence against the subs on the third-party basis? And would that help you with your indemnity issue?
I believe we could probably sue a claim of negligence against them, contending that the damages that they caused us as a result of their negligence was the liability to which it exposed Scoggins to the school district. My guess is that would be entirely redundant, however, of the contractual claims. But that wouldn't bind the school district. I mean, their claim could still remain just a breach of contract, so that it wouldn't come under Chapter 33.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Morgan. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.